I'm Kyle Turner.
I'm Connor Good.
And this is Media Query, a podcast here to queer the conversation between TV, film, and all of the things. Each episode, we ask our stories and storytellers one question to blend up our culture and make our discussion just a little more fluid. So, Connor, have you ever heard of this show called Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt?
No, I've been in a bunker for the past 15 years.
Because of your dumbness?
Yeah, oh god, I love that. That's like the first joke of the whole show. I love that. Apocalypse. We caused it with our dumbness. Yeah, that's fantastic. I have heard of that show.
The Great Emily Nussbaum. All hail. I'm not kidding about that, because I once stood next to her and there was just like beaming light from everywhere. And I didn't realize it was her until she walked away. But, like... But Emily Nussbaum recently wrote this amazing piece on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt in The New Yorker in order to remind us that it might actually be, underneath it all, a story of someone recovering from rape with a strikingly sunny disposition. Nussbaum writes, quote, "By making horrible things funny, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt suggests that surviving could be more than just living on. It could be a kind of freedom, too," unquote. This making horrible things funny has always seemed to be a point of style with show creators Robert Carlock and Tina Fey, something we can recognize all through 30 Rock, but possibly never more overtly than here in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Today, we'd like to narrow in on the character of Titus Andromedon, definitely a starring character with a commanding role on the show, but so arguably the, quote, gay best friend of the dynamic. In what capacity might he be an independent character with his own complexity? Like, in what capacity are his subplots parody or commentary? Is Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt making horrible things funny in regard to Titus, or just making things funny at his expense? Which leads us to this week's media query. Can gay best friends like Titus Andromedon be strong as hell, too?
I think before we, before we get into the discussion of Titus and queer dynamics on the show, I think it's good to unpack our feelings on the show overall. What do you think?
I actually liked it more on the second round because I watched.
Oh, so you've rewatched the whole thing? Because I rewatched like half of it.
I rewatched. And then picked and choose. I rewatched the whole thing within the course of about a week or less.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It is. It definitely has exactly what 30 Rock has. I would say, and even in a more complex way, where you pick up on so much more.
Yeah.
The second or third time around, mm-hmm. I've seen. One episode that we're definitely going to talk about today, I've seen like three times, mm-hmm. and each time it's like, holy crap, he just did, and then like you see these jokes that obviously you never see the first time because it moves mm-hmm. so fast, mm-hmm. and that's trademark Carlock and Faye, but we'll get
yes.
to that.
Yes, I think that this show is not necessarily better than 30 Rock, but it is denser than 30 Rock, as far as its jokes go, because I actually had a dream that I was arguing with someone about the greatness of the show, because he doesn't like it. In real life, he does not like it. And I had a dream that I rewatched the pilot with him to prove to him how good it was. And I counted the number of jokes in the first 15 minutes, or maybe less than that. It was actually within the first... that first section where they're in the bunker, I think I counted 6 jokes in my dream, mind you. But I think the denseness of the writing is really something to marvel at. There's just joke after joke after joke, and the construction of the jokes is really fascinating because the punchlines don't exist as one would expect them to. They talked about it on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour recently. I think it was last episode. And they talked about this one line from Carol Kane where she says, "No man would ever invent high heels because no woman has invented anything." See, you think you know where that punchline is going, but then it just takes a left turn. and it's jokes like that which are just so absurd. It is,
yeah,
it's really incredible the veracity of this writing. I'm just really in awe of it, because the reason why I watched it a second time was because I knew that I missed stuff. I think even more than watching 30 Rock, I think I've seen the entirety of 30 Rock maybe 2 or 3 times now. But this is a show that I will go back to multiple times because there's just so much to look at. It's whether it's visual gags, sight gags or dialogue gags. It's just there's so much to mine from it. But there are certainly caveats to the show. It has a race problem, regardless of whether the actors want to admit it or not. I do think that Arthur Chu wrote this really great piece for Slate, I believe, that says the show has a race problem not because it is stereotypical, but because it doesn't bother doing anything with those stereotypes. It doesn't go far enough with them in order to make a point. So my immediate reaction is that I really like the show. The writing is incredibly dense, and there's a lot to mine from it. I do think that the courtroom subplot is stupid. I don't particularly like that section. I wish they gave Carol Kane more stuff to do, because I think she is at the moment basically a white Tracy Morgan, but less funny often.
Really? Okay.
Well, Tracy Jordan. Tracy Jordan.
Yeah, that's what I thought you meant. Despite the fact that you're saying like it's so dense, it's also a show that like you watch when you have like an exhausting day. And you want to come home and watch this because Kimmy Schmidt is so refreshing. Mm-hmm. And I think this show is incredibly challenging mm-hmm. to write, because what they are doing here, which Emily Nussbaum points out so well in this piece, is they're dealing with some really dark shit underneath this. And the other thing is that it's not avoiding the dark shit either. The fact that there are these jokes made about how
underneath it all, in the bunker.
Yeah, well, that underneath it all, Kimmy is actually dealing with the fact that she is insanely damaged and depressed about things, and that like when the Martin Short's character makes that line about her scream lines that Nussbaum points out, all of that stuff is completely in the text, and it takes someone like Nussbaum really pointing that out, being a genius critic, but pointing that out to really kind of realize, wow, this show is super distinct and unique in what it's trying to do, and that makes it all the more admirable. And it's lots of fun. And you're right. The jokes are there. It's just a super refreshing show. It's, I love how she points out, again, I'm going back to Nussbaum, surprise, surprise, points out that this is Leslie Knope if Leslie Knope has been through hell. It's an incredibly refreshing and empowering show. And I love its take on, not just New York, but popular culture. Mm-hmm. Very much in the 30 Rock way, but I think it's a little more, it's a little different. It's embracing the more zaniness and subversive of like how we deal with like headlines and tweets and things that are of the day. But yeah, in general, I really love it.
I would like to make the quick argument that I think is actually closer to Arrested Development in its first three seasons than it is to 30 Rock.
I would agree with that. I think this is really, I think tonally to me, this show is so identifiable. The DNA of the last season of 30 Rock is in this show, you know, just baked in there. I can't separate them. And the music makes that even, you know, we're just broken records here, repeating what everyone else has said. So maybe we should just get to our discussion. So regarding Titus, I generally really, really like the character. It's hard for me. It is definitely, the character is different from Dufan on 30 Rock, which Titus Burgess also played. But I can't help but think of them as the same character just because of his performance, but it's definitely a different character. I generally really like the character. I generally really like the jokes of the character. I love the personality of the character. I do think there is something that makes him distinct in the show and a powerful force in the show. I think the reason that I want to talk about Kimmy Schmidt from my perspective today and the show, the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, is that I'm a little like confused how I feel actually about the character and how the show uses the character in various different aspects. Specifically in episode 110, Kimmy's in a love triangle. This is the episode where Titus decides to go see a straight acting coach so he can more effectively land a straight role, a quote unquote straight role at the theme restaurant
in Entourage
that he works at. Yeah, and like eventually there's like a supposedly an audition for Entourage 2, the movie. And he shows up, he finds out about the straight acting coach, which is its own play on words. But he shows up, and this straight acting coach is played by Dean Norris, who is just vamping on the masculinity factor to an absolute extreme. And the thing that that I'm confused about with, like, this is just one example of one of these subplots, or these B plots, really, I'm confused about is that there is, like, kind of this line that the episode walks with the things that Titus has to go through to be able to act as straight. So, one of the things that he's not allowed to sip a drink from a drink with a straw because it looks like he's sucking a leprechaun penis is what Dean Norris says. And like stuff like this, stuff that kind of in the summation of these acts implies that to be gay is not to be strong and not to be able to be independent, not to be able to hold your own or hold up a wall. And there's something I think where the show is trying to kind of parody the idea of being straight and all of that. But at the same time, there is this moment that really kind of saps the whole show parodying itself when, the catharsis is that like Dean Norris has this moment where he says it was in your heart all along. Like essentially like all you needed was to believe in yourself to pass as straight. Cause he tests Titus and he, and there is no audition for Entourage 2, and he's just hoping Titus is able to figure it out himself. And that is the moment where I get confused. What is the show telling me? Is it just satirizing to the point of absolute, like, meaninglessness? Does that make sense?
I think that it is satirizing this idea of what, quote-unquote, straight acting means, of that performativity, but I don't think it does it very well. I think of this as a lesser version of a particular sequence from The Birdcage, which was originally a French film called Le Cochon Folle from the 1970s, which has the exact same scene in it, where the two gay partners in the film are preparing for their son's fiancé's family to be coming, and the son's fiancé, her family is very conservative and very homophobic. So the intention is to have the patriarch of that particular of this dynamic teach the more effeminate character how to quote unquote act straight, and it's done very concisely in both versions. I'll actually explain why I prefer the remake to the original, but he says it's in the walk, it's in the way that you present yourself. And there's a specific reference to John Wayne, which I think is very interesting because he is this stalwart icon of masculinity. But in the original version, I think it's a little too subtle in order to get that point across that performativity is, you know, what it says in its very name, performative. It's supposed to be acting a particular role that doesn't actually exist. And it works better with actors like Nathan Lane and Robin Williams because they are much louder and they can stress that point, stress those ideas and stress that point in a concise way. And what Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt does is take that general scene, which lasts about 5 minutes, and stretches out to 15, I think. It basically traverses in this montage the same kind of ideas over and over again, and doesn't exactly subvert them, but just presents them as if we are supposed to already understand that satire, which I think is a problem with a lot of comedy lately. And
I think you're hitting the nail on the head here.
There are so many comedians who are whining about having to apologize for jokes and about not having context when they don't think that they should have context, but to present humor, to present a joke, makes a statement, regardless of whether you intend it to or not. And so context ends up being very important. And just presenting something on a platter without really commenting on it and assuming that your audience knows what you're presenting, assuming that your audience already is in on the joke and assumes the context, I think is kind of unfair. And then that's where the fallacy lies, because then it leaves the audience to do all the legwork, and it makes the writing seem lazy.
And it could also reinforce the idea that, like, these are just norms. Mm-hmm. This is exactly, like, what a straight person is as opposed to a gay person, a male specifically. Someone who identifies as a man specifically. And the other thing I think that really rubs me the wrong way about it is that Titus even cares in the first place. It's just, it's a little concerning to me that, like, such a confident character, or someone who's been set up as such a confident character, he's really sure of himself at some points to a fault. That all of a sudden for this arc that he kind of is okay with, you know, accepting this and, like, going after that and caring about it in the first place. That he can't find a way, which I think might even be more entertaining, find a way, and challenging as a writer, to find a way for him to own the way he decides to express himself and also go after this one role that he wants to get, which is supposedly a straight role where he marries the character in a theme restaurant, marries a woman at the end. But if anything, I would also want to see this character, Titus, challenge his boss as to and find a way to kind of subvert that. But instead, it kind of is just like goes through the motions of living up to straight ideals, which to me, I think recalls like everything that's the heteronormative, homonormative crisis right now of and that's, I think, why I get so upset about it, or I get confused, not upset. I get confused and concerned. It recalls this idea of like just in general living up to the idea of like heteronormative marriage, needing certain things, needing certain rights, needing certain recognition, and to a fault that we're not thinking about our own complexity and how we kind of fit into culture.
And I think what's ironic is that though this particular sequence and the ideology it wants to tackle, that it's not done very well, it does something else which is similar, much better, where Titus puts on the werewolf costume and is treated as a better human being than as a black person.
Yeah, that is a fantastic pitch. Very simple, elegant idea. And yeah, you're right. That's carried out so much better, but it's also so much simpler.
Mm-hmm. The thing with Titus Burgess's performance is that as DeFuan, he is constructed as a stereotype and not really done. He's funny, but not much is done with his character beyond acting as a stereotype.
I just wanted to say, like, arguably the thing about DeFuan and every character on 30 Rock, and especially the Queen of Jordan characters, is that you can make the argument that every single one of those is an archetype pushed to an stereotypical extreme to obviously be a part of a satire. And I think you can make an argument here, but, you know, it's questioning, like, how much of that is good and bad.
There's kind of a minstrel-esque tone to DeFuan, if I may say so.
Yeah, I get that.
And in this... Mm-hmm. I do think there is a hint of complexity. I do think that they are trying to develop him to be autonomous and his own complex character as a foil to Kimmy. I think that is something that they are working on, which has not necessarily come to fruition. But the point on the stereotype thing is that he is the male version of the stereotype of the sassy black woman.
Yeah.
That's how he functions, and that is how that archetype functions. And I think it's interesting to have that, because it's often white gay males who do this, appropriate this black culture, this particular black female culture. And I think it's interesting to have a black male kind of do the same thing, despite the fact that it essentially originates from them. Watch Paris is Burning and you'll understand better what I'm trying to get at, but it is a culture that they essentially created and constructed for themselves. Ball culture. I don't know where I'm going with this.
I mean, arguably that's the same with DeFuan, right?
I don't think it is the same with DeFuan. I think DeFuan is much more stereotypical, and I think they do less, they put less effort in trying to make him a piece of satire than just making him a stereotype.
Okay, but what I'm asking is do you think DeFuan appropriates black female identity?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
I think the, oddly enough, one passing comment seems to be like the thing which most is indicative of this, in my opinion, and it's when Kimmy is about to reveal her identity and she says, I'm from Indiana, and then he interrupts her and says, oh, so that's why you're so basic. Basic is a very feminine thing to say, stereotypically speaking.
Oh, I see. I never clicked that.
Am I wrong? Head. I could be wrong. It's usually said by white girls, though.
Basic. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I've ever thought of that as being something that's associated as being feminine and something.
Basic bitch?
That's a little different.
But he's using it in that context.
Yeah.
That's okay. Why you're a basic bitch, because you're from Indiana and you don't know anything.
Okay. I don't know.
I could be wrong on this, totally.
Are there any other stories that you want to bring up in talking about Titus? I will say he has a fantastic comedic presence.
Oh, yeah. I generally speaking, I really like his character. I think he's hilarious. And I don't find it as problematic as other characters or as other things doing on the show, but I do think it is certainly a topic to be talked about.
One thing that concerns me, and we framed our question, can gay best friends like Titus Andromeda be strong as hell too? One thing that concerns me is, while the show wants to satirize the idea of Titus being Kimmy, the main character's gay best friend, it completely buys into it. Specifically, episode 110, it opens with them doing kind of a meta thing where it says, open on Kimmy walking down the sidewalk with Titus, and Titus asks Kimmy a question, and it's all about her love life and how he's helping her out as a gay best friend. And they point to it too. They point to it. There's one episode where it's like, isn't this how we operate in nature? Like, they make kind of like a joke about their responsibility and roles and their symbiotic relationship as like friend and gay best friend, or as main character and gay best friend, as protagonist and gay best friend. They make a joke about that, but then the show completely buys into it. And so the joke then is mute. The joke is reinforced. The show reinforces the joke. Mm. So that kind of rubs me the wrong way about it. But in general, I really like Titus as a character, but I think there's enough to be concerned to have this discussion.
Yes.
Anything else you want to say?
He's promiscuous with that time when he tries to seduce Brandon.
Oh, yeah, with the corn.
Oh, yeah, there's a really funny part where he's trying to self-identify in terms of what tribe he belongs to. And it's when he's unable to seduce Kimmy's friend's fiancé, Brandon, who is gay. And he's like, oh, no, am I a bear? Am I a daddy? Or a Huxtable? And I think that's very interesting, because Titus is quote-unquote older. He's like in his mid-30s, right? He's in his mid-30s. He's black. He's effeminate, which puts him in an interesting place within the queer community, within the gay male community particularly, because at a certain point you become useless. And it's something we kind of touched upon in our Grindr and Tinder discussion, but at a certain point you become useless because you don't fit a homonormative ideal of what you're supposed to be. If you don't fit into a particular tribe, if you don't fit into a particular box, and if you don't fit into multiple boxes that you're supposed to fit into, you don't have a role anymore. So I think that existential crisis that he has in that episode, which I think Kimmy kisses a boy? Or no, Kimmy goes on a... I don't know. It's when, you know, when Brandon comes and they call him an escotoir. But I think that is a very interesting crisis for him to go through. I think that's an interesting crisis for him to go through. Because it does mean that he has to question his viability within that community. So that's another factor. And it puts him into this kind of limbo, which might be unfortunate. And it might actually be the show questioning his role within the show as a whole, questioning that gay best friend role, because if he's useless as a sexual being, if he essentially becomes asexual, besides him making lewd comments as punchlines, that means that he is forced back into that role of gay best friend without much autonomy or without much agency in his own right.
And tell me if this is your experience, that like usually the gay best friend archetype is played by a very twink branded attractive person.
Yeah. Or they can be slightly overweight in the case of that character in Mean Girls.
Mean Girls. I knew you were going to say Mean Girls. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true.
Damien. Too gay to
Can function. We talk about the Esquitar thing real quick? Because I think the whole Esquitar joke reveals... I mean, I don't know anything about Robert Carlock's personal life. I don't know much about Tina Fey's besides... Bossy Pants, what she wrote about in Bossy Pants. And I don't know much about like the other staff writers on the show and producers. But I think that joke reveals kind of like where the show comes at portraying queer culture from the outside, from an outside understanding that like wants to poke fun at like knowing from their own gay best friends, you know, like knowing their own relationships and these people being friends in their life, but actually not identifying and understanding what their experiences are like. That Esquitar joke is to me that kind of litmus test or reveals that. Mm-hmm. It's funny.
It's funny.
It's a funny joke, but it doesn't understand or empathize with queer culture.
It's funny, but it also is not different from the tons of jokes about gay culture that exist in other sitcoms, which is...
Awful sitcoms.
Because gay culture is often held up as musical theater, fancy things.
And also something unfamiliar, because the whole joke is it's a secret language the gay people have. It's kind of like a development of the parody of the joke of where we all, like, a lot of times joke about, like, oh, let me get out my gay agenda, and, you know, like, that kind of thing. The secret gay agenda that, like, is passed around at these secret meetings, you know what I mean?
Secret, like, handshakes and whatnot.
Yeah, that kind of shit. So, that's kind of, I think that lends some insight into understanding how the show operates like that. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else you want to say?
I will say that I do think, I did, my heart fluttered a little bit when Titus was like, what's that movie with Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant that's directed by Stanley Donen? And they said Charade. I was like, yes, Charade's my favorite film. And I also was very happy that Titus was given an opportunity to sing Cole Porter songs, because, again, pandering to my interests.
Yeah. And one thing that should be mentioned as we close this out is that one thing that's really great about Titus, even if he does sometimes fit the role of gay best friend in the show, is that he's never totally defined by that. These are jokes in between. I love the part about this character, how his character is just so self-obsessed that, like, he can't stop asking her questions about her experience, but he keeps saying, like for instance, it's the, like, third episode to the end or whatever, like, when she's about to go for the trial, it's the episode when he goes and watches the library, how he's trying to, like, support her and, like, say supportive things, but he can't, but all he's saying is, like, I'm going to go watch it at the library. Or he just, like, asks all these questions about her experience that, like, he shouldn't be asking, and he's trying to be supportive and, like, say, like, I'm there for you, but I'm going to go watch it at the library. Like, that kind of thing. That's great. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that is today's media query. No feedback this week because we just recorded our previous episode like 5 minutes ago. But as always, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'll read it on the air. And you can always send us feedback at mediaquery.tumblr.com.
Spelled just like the show. Don't forget suggestions too. You can always send us suggestions and links to check out that you want us to check out for future episodes, whatever, just for fun. I guess if they wanted, they could send us like cat videos or GIFs, that would be fine. I guess we're, you know,
you should send us.
We have
money.
An obligation to post them on our feedback Tumblr, but
yeah, but you should maybe send something us relevant. Money. Send us money. PayPal us. Donate. Also send us movies. Yeah, I can always go for those. Not that
Kyle likes Criterion.
Yes, but my April Fool's joke was me selling them all. Did you see that?
Sorry.
My April Fool's joke was that I was selling them all.
Oh, no, I didn't see that. Holy shit, I'd never believe that. You would never trick me on that. That's impossible.
I'm kind of disappointed that you didn't see it, because I was wondering if you would have believed it.
No, I wouldn't have.
Ugh, you know me too well. I don't think I would have. You know me too well. Not that we don't already have, like, tons of things we want to talk about, but we want to hear what's fascinating you these days, because we care about our listeners.
Yeah, so send us suggestions.
Yes. Before we let you know what next episode's topic will be, Connor, where can people find you on the internet?
I like how you said that. Super cool. Super aloof and cool. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Connor M. Good. That's C-O-N-N-E-R M. Good. I Instagram graphics for the show you're listening to right now, as well as a photo log of the stories I'm currently inhaling. You can find launch pads to everything else I do, if you're interested, at ConnorMGood.com, including my Tumblr, theaudienceisthemessage.tumblr.com. Follow it if you like Marshall McLuhan. And that's where I post my micro musings on media.
And you can find me on Twitter at Tyle Kerner, T-Y-L-E-K-U-R-N-E-R, because I'm a very creative person. I write about movies on the internet for a bunch of places. But my main homestay is as assistant editor of MovieMezzanine.com. Thank you. It took me like 5 takes last episode. You can find my collected works of writing at TyleKerner.tumblr.com. And I recently wrote a piece for The Black Mariah, because I still actually write there. About Barbara Streisand's Yentl, which is about...
Whoa, really?
Yeah, which is about a young woman who...
Throwback.
Who lives as a man so she can continue her education about Jewish theological law. And it's actually really interesting in the way that it plays with queer dynamics and transness. So that's cool. It's actually a much better movie than it really ought to be. I was not expecting it to be good.
I remember my great-grandma had the album to that, like the record, and I listened to it as one of the first records I ever listened to.
Oh.
Those are my earliest Barbara Streisand moments. But anyways.
Barbara Streisand is the thing that I really never got into except for Hello, Dolly. But I...
I'm not a huge fan, to be honest.
I am not at all sorry for the title of that essay. It's called Papa, Can You Queer Me?
As everyone knows at this point, everyone who listens, Kyle just loves his punny titles.
Yes, I do. That's the only reason why I'm going to academia.
What would happen if, like, you were, like, the sole person making the titles for these episodes? What would it be like? They're already punny. But what would it be like if you were doing it?
I don't know. I feel like I'd be a millionaire.
Anyways, our show is produced by me, with lots and lots of help from Kyle. Our sumptuous music is You're My Thrill, covered by Voodoo Suite, and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license, which means that Media Query is too.
Woohoo! And if you like what we're up to here on Media Query, slide us a review on iTunes, and please queer the conversation in your own circles.
That's it for today. We're queer, and we'll still be here next time on Media Query.
So, Connor, what are we going to do next episode?
Well, we're still going to put off the superhero episode because we're still waiting to get that one guest and to time that with a superhero release. But next episode, it looks like we're going to be talking about texting etiquette and texting culture and emojis and emoticons and acronyms and even the idea of sexting and where gender constructs show up there and where heteronormativity might show up there. And I think that explains what we're up to, right?
Winky face. So that leads us to our query of this episode. Can Bay.
Can Bay be as strong as hell too?
Which
we're done. That's it.
Yep, that's it.